Well, tonight we're going to talk about Tales of the Bizarre. Mark Hartzman back with us. He was last with me 9 years ago, and we're going to talk about all kinds of strange things, including his latest work, The Embalmed Head of Oliver Cromwell, a memoir. I kid you not. We'll talk about that and so much more next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. Mark Hartzman, of course, is the author of a number of works, including, of course, Found on eBay, The Anti-Social Network Journal, God Made Me Do It, American Sideshow, The Embalmed Head of Oliver Cromwell. He's been a contributor to the Weird News sections of AOL, The Huffington Post. He's got a career as a creative director, and here he is back on Coast to Coast. 9 years, Mark? My gosh, where's the time flown? Way too long.
Too quick.
I mean, when we start talking, we were into your earlier books, for crying out loud. You really have done a lot over the 9 years.
I've been keeping very busy, yeah.
So definitely. I'm going to get into, in the second half of our show, this incredible work of the Embalmed Head of Oliver Cromwell. And you know, we'll talk about him and his legacy and his life and some of the things. But how did you get interested in these strange things?
Well, I've always been sort of fascinated by the odd and the unusual since I was a kid. And I think it kind of started for me with buying the old Guinness Book of World Records, you know, when it was just the small paperback books. And I would just sort of study those first 20 or 30 pages that were on the human body. And I was so fascinated by Robert Wadlow, the world's tallest man, who was 8'11½". And it would go through, like, the growth charts, and it'd have, you know, a variety of photos of him. And it was just, I just couldn't believe that someone could be that tall. You know, it was just so amazing to me. So there was him, and then, of course, there was, you know, the world's fattest man, Robert Earl Hughes, and the fattest twins, the people with the long fingernails that curled up and everything. You know, they always had those pictures. So that stuff always really got to me. And I loved Ripley's Believe It or Not when I was on TV, I think with Jack Palance as the host. And there were other things that just, like, I love Time Bandits by Terry Gilliam, you know, with the seven midgets traveling through time. So all those kind of odd things. I saw The Elephant Man. I was probably too young to be watching that, but I watched The Elephant Man at a very early age, and, you know, he found his way into my new book, The Embalmed Head of Oliver Cromwell, a memoir. So those things always just sort of stuck with me, and I got more into it again in college when I had started a magazine called Backwash, and I started getting into more sideshow stuff and writing more about different sideshow performers. And then that magazine led up to doing the book American Sideshow.
The Elephant Man, if I remember, his real name was John Merrick.
Joseph that. Merrick.
Joseph, yeah.
Yeah.
And what it was an incredible movie, really was.
Yeah, very, yeah, sad movie, but sort of triumphant as well.
When these bizarre stories would pop, it kind of reminds me of the day during Charles Fort and his, you know, the Fortean society and some of the things that they did. What do you think, Mark, is so fascinating to all of us about these unusual, bizarre stories? Because I'm like you. I mean, I really love reading them. I mean, I could read books and books and books on these strange stories. What is it about them?
I think that we're just all innately curious. You know, the curiosity is one thing that will always sell, you know. So when we see something that's just different and unusual, we want to know more about it. You know, I think that's what made circuses and sideshows do so well, particularly in the 19th century and the early 20th century when there really wasn't any other way to see anything different. You know, it was like once a year when the sideshow or the circus would stop in town, you could see things that you'd never seen before, people doing unusual things, people that had some sort of, you know, abnormality or some kind of anomaly. So, you know, curiosity is something that we all have, and when we have a chance to explore it, that can be very exciting. And these things that are bizarre give us that opportunity.
Well, they sure do. And as you began to research and write the various stories that you've written in your books, how did you first start? Where did you go, Mark, to get the information?
Well, with American Sideshow, for example, that had started off with just meeting a lot of different current performers. which was hugely helpful. The more people I met, the more people they referred me to. And it was great because, you know, I was very passionate about the topic, and I think that always came through with them. So they were always really helpful in saying, oh, you should talk to this person, talk to this person. And a lot of them were, you know, a lot of them were like younger performers, maybe, you know, in their 30s, 40s, 50s. And then there were other people I got to speak with who were in their 70s and had been around, obviously, you know, seen a lot in their time. So one of them, for example, was a showman named Ward Hall, who's just a fantastic showman. And he's been in the business since he was 15 years old. So he's just known, he knew pretty much every major performer from the, you know, the mid or the early 20th century, really, to, you know, till current day. So he was hugely helpful. He had so many wonderful stories to share with me. So that was a huge help with research. And then it was just going through newspaper archives, going to the library. There's, you know, wonderful archives to go through and just finding all the different articles that have been written about different performers. And, of course, you know, it's kind of fun to go through that because the journalists were writing stuff that was surely exaggerated. The publicists were giving them exaggerated stories about, you know, how tall their giants were and how short their little people were. So that was fun to go through. And, I mean, all of that was part of Sideshow. You know, the exaggerations were part of the fun. So that was a large part of the research for that one. With a book like God Made Me Do It, that was kind of a fun book to do because it started off with the concept of writing about people who've said crazy things that God told them to do and then sort of giving the context of their story. And so I had that idea, and I said, well, you know, let me see if I can find a bunch of stories like that to make a book. And I was really amazed at how many stories I found. There was no shortage of crazy stories about things that God allegedly told people to do, whether it was funny, goofy things or absolutely horrific things. It was a lot of fun just going to the library and digging up different news stories.
And for you, while you were doing your research, what did you find to be one of the most bizarre stories that are hanging out there?
Sideshow related, or I mean, for me, really, one of
I guess
the
it could be
stories,
anything, right?
One of the most bizarre stories I came across was this Cromwell story, which I know we were going to talk about more later.
Yeah.
But just finding, and this was actually going to be part of a different book idea I had, but when I came across the story, just finding out that this embalmed head traveled through history for 300 years, from 1661 to 1960, that just really astonished me. I'd never heard a story like that before. So that's sort of made me say, I have to do something with this story. And the idea of writing the head's memoir came to me. So then I set off on that path.
I used to like seeing these 40-inch stories of frogs falling from the sky and just bizarre stories like that, too. They just make you wonder. So many strange things happen on this planet, most of which are probably explainable, but a lot, Mark, aren't, are they?
True. And just to jump back to that for a second, I wrote a story for the Huffington Post Weird News about just what you mentioned, the frogs falling from the sky, because I love that those Fortean stories about that. So I had done a little research around it, and it was not just frogs. There were all sorts of creatures that have fallen from the sky in these crazy storms, and there are explanations for it, although even the explanations, you know, the explanations are pretty bizarre, too, like, wow, that caused that many frogs to rain from the sky. Hmm? So that's always kind of fun. But I do love the stories where you're not quite sure what's going on, and it's always, it's really fun because I love the element of mystery with some of these things where you're, you know, we think everything's explainable, but sometimes there's these stories you're not quite sure. One of them that I liked a lot was, you know, and I'm sure there's, you know, there's certainly explanations for this, but there was a photographer named William Mumler who was a spirit photographer, and there's a wonderful book about him. And so in the late 1800s, post-Civil War, he was taking a lot of these spirit photographs, and people were so desperate to have any kind of contact with their loved ones who had died in the war that they would go to this photographer who supposedly had no idea how he was doing this. So that there's the whole story about him goes that he would take these photographs and the spirit would appear behind the person. And what was so amazing about him, and you know, obviously there's ways to do that with photography, there's no question about that, but what made his story kind of interesting was that he would have these photographs of like someone's son, for example, who had died, maybe from a sickness, not from the war. And back then, people didn't just have a bunch of photographs laying around. You know, that was a pretty rare thing. So in some cases, there were no existing photographs of the child or the loved one for him to have, you know, found and then somehow put into a photograph behind them. But people would swear that it was that person that was seen in the ghost image standing behind him in the photograph.
And this was pre-Photoshop, wasn't it?
Oh, of course. Yeah, exactly. Way back. So they would have to do stuff, you know, in their dark room just with the negatives, the plates that they had, and how they developed them. So there was obviously people were skeptical of this, other photographers, and said, oh, there's no way you can replicate this. If you came to my studio, if you use my equipment, you'd never be able to do this because you're hiding something in your room. So one of the stories goes that they invited Mumler to his photography studio, and sure enough, he replicated the same results. I couldn't figure out how he did it because it was his equipment, and there was nothing, you know, no trickery going on in his dark room. And then P.T. Barnum actually had, you know, assumed he was a fraud because, you know, Barnum would do that. He would, you know, prove people were fraudulent, kind of like Houdini would do as well. But he took him to court, and the court did not find him guilty. They could not prove he had done anything wrong, so he was actually let off of the charges.
And Barnum himself,
though, amazed me.
Wasn't Barnum himself into all kinds of trickery?
Yeah, but he knew it was trickery. He wasn't pretending it to be anything else. So Barnum would just let people decide for their own what was real and what wasn't. He wouldn't he wouldn't try to convince you it was real. It's like the Fiji mermaid. He would just present that to you, and you could choose to believe, or you could
sort of like our show, Mark. I mean,
exactly.
We don't put people down. We don't, you know, if somebody calls and says they've been abducted by aliens, you know, far be it for us to tell him no, it never happened.
Right. I mean, those stories. I mean, alien stories have always fascinated me too, and you know, you do have to wonder. I mean, some of these things, you know, could they be true? You know, I'm always amazed when you look up at the sky, or you just realize how vast the universe is. It seems very odd to think that there could be nothing else out there. So those stories always intrigue me as well.
Ever come across our friend Lee Spiegel, who's writing for Huffington Post now?
Oh yeah, I know Lee. Yeah,
Good guy.
I was writing for AOL Weird News, it was me and Lee, and Buck Wolf was the editor.
Oh yeah, we just had Buck on a few months ago. He's a great guy too.
Yeah, Buck is awesome. So yeah, we were just a small crew: Dave Moy and a few other guys. And then Huffington Post took over, and yeah, I know Lee is still working with them. So yeah, he's a good guy. But yeah, he's a big UFO guy.
In terms of like the frogs falling from the sky, what do you think happened? I mean, there's got to be a scientific example and a scientific reason for that, I would think.
There is, and you know, I it's been a while since I wrote about that, but it was some kind of whirlwind, I think, that picks up off of a pond or something, and it'll just sort of scoop them up and then carry them along until they fall down, you know, once that's sort of dissipated. So it is a scientific explanation. It's bizarre for sure. It's hard to believe it happens, but and like I said, it happens with more than frogs too, which is so weird. I can't even imagine what that must be like to look out the window and see these creatures falling to the ground.
Especially back then,
you know, when they had no scientific explanation, you can imagine how crazy that must have been and what they must have thought.
And you've heard about the story, of course, of you know, the cow up in a tree. How the heck does that happen?
I'm not sure I know the story of the cow in the tree.
Oh, my gosh, yeah. There was a cow found up in a tree. It was dead. But, you know, who in the heck would put a cow up in a tree? So a lot of people surmise that ETs picked up the cow, did whatever they had to do with it, and dumped it, dropped it back down.
No tornado or anything like that it hit?
Well, that's a good question. Nothing at that point, but I wonder if some kind of a cyclone quickly popped in, picked him up, and, you know, off
right.
he went.
Right. It seems like a lot of effort for someone to put a cow personally in a tree. That sounds heavy.
We're going to be talking in a moment with Mark Hartzman about his latest work, The Embalmed Head of Oliver Cromwell. His website linked up to, with coasttocoastam.com, americansideshow.com. And tell us a little bit of the music video that we have on The Embalmed Head.
Yeah, so I have a friend of mine at my my office. Steffi Copeland is a wonderful singer, songwriter, pianist, and she wrote a song for the book called "Hey Oliver Cromwell," which is just really fun. She read through the book and she just wrote these amazing lyrics that sort of take the listener through the actual story. It's the most catchiest song you'll ever hear about an embalmed head. I can promise that. And I wanted to make a video of it so we could put something up on YouTube as well. So another friend of mine at the office, who's a great animator, took the illustrations from the cover. The cover was fully illustrated by an old partner of mine named V. Long, who's a fantastic illustrator. So she took his illustrations and animated them to the music. So you see, the lyrics go by and the Cromwell head is kind of singing along. And it just takes you through the different little vignettes that go through the book. So it was a lot of fun. I'm so honored that they wrote Steffi wrote the song and my friend Dana animated it. So they did a terrific job. So I hope people go to the site and check it out.
Hollywood seems to love these kinds of stories too, Mark.
I hope so.
they look at the American Horror Story and things like that, where they have these very bizarre things happening all over the place. When Ripley's, believe it or not, when they were doing their thing, they accumulated incredible stories from all over the planet. That must have been pretty darn extensive to do, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, Ripley traveled to, I think probably close to 200 countries or more during his lifetime. And, I mean, he really hit it huge. He started as a sports cartoonist and just came up with this idea, I think a last-minute idea of a believe-it-or-not concept with sports-related stories of, like, guys walking backwards and, just weird little sports bits.
Right.
And then it took off, and suddenly the whole country just loved his cartoons, and it was in, the newspapers all across the country, and he was getting thousands and thousands of letters every day from people sharing their own believe-it-or-nots. And then it just became such a moneymaker. He was able to, his paper was sending him all over the world to find these new stories to draw and write about. So, it was incredibly profitable. He made a ton of money, and, what an amazing life that man lived. Fascinating.
When you were doing your research for this, did you come across anything that you did not want to include in any of your books because it was just too bizarre?
For God Made Me Do It, I did. Yes, I mentioned earlier that the book kind of covers a range of stories that are just sort of absurd and funny, and ones that are a bit more horrific. We have murders and cannibalism and things like that God instructed. Okay. But some of the murders were so gruesome, I didn't want to include them. Things like mothers killing their children.
I don't blame you. Well, when we come back, let's talk about your latest work, The Embalmed Head of Oliver Cromwell. I kid you not. Beyond Belief, that's our television program, and there's some incredible episodes I'd like you to watch by going to the website beyondbelief.com. There's special promotion underway, 99 cents for an entire month to watch those programs. All kinds of shows that run the gamut from the strange, the mysterious, and the bizarre to alternative medicine, you name it. We've got it at beyondbelief.com. And welcome back to Coast. Oliver Cromwell was born in 1599. He died in 1658. Now, he was an English military and political leader, later the Lord Protector of the Commonwealth of England, Scotland, and Ireland. And we're talking now with Mark Hartzman about his story, The Embalmed Head of Oliver Cromwell. Mark, that title alone says volumes. Tell me about this.
Well, yeah, so like you said, he lived from 1599 to 1658. And after he died, his body was embalmed. and he was buried in Westminster Abbey. And just to give a little quick background before that, so like you said, he was a military leader, became Lord Protector, but he did that by having Charles I executed in 1649. And that was kind of, you know, I mentioned earlier my book, God Made Me Do It. That was sort of one of history's biggest God Made Me Do It stories, where he believed he was on a mission from God to end the monarchy. And so he did. You know, Charles I was beheaded. Cromwell takes over as Lord Protector. He did not want to be a king because he believed that was just the wrong thing. And so anyway, then once he died and was embalmed, he's in Westminster Abbey for a few years. His son had taken over the Lord Protectorate, but then abdicated. He just wasn't the leader his father was. And Charles II restored the monarchy shortly after. So Charles II was not pleased with Cromwell and the other regicides for having, you know, executed his dad. So he exhumed the body and hung it along with two other bodies, two of the other regicides, hung it in public, and then beheaded Cromwell and put the head in the other heads of the other regicides as well, put him atop Westminster Hall. And it sat there for 25 years, this embalmed head. Still had features on it, hairs and, you know, flakes of skin.
Jeez.
And, you know, it's just a crazy scene. It's kind of like, you know, if people watched first season of Game of Thrones when Ned Stark was beheaded, they stuck his head on the spike. I mean, that's what they used to do. So Cromwell sat up there for 25 years.
What preserved the head for so long, Mark?
It was embalmed. They did a good job of the embalming.
They sure did, I guess.
Obviously weather started to erode it away a little bit, but I have a photo of the head in the book. And obviously, since it's a photo, it's more recent than at that time. So that was from the early 1900s or so. And you can still see the hairs. You can still see, like, features on it. It's just amazing.
Did the head go on some kind of tour or something like that?
Yeah. So what happened was, I'll kind of run you through the brief history of the 300 years. So after about 25 years or so, you know, it was on a wooden stake with an iron tip that had poked through the top of the skull. And the wooden stake just sort of, I guess, had eroded over time with weather, and a storm eventually blew it down. So the head fell to the ground, and a sentry picked it up, took it home, kind of hid it away because he didn't want to be caught with the head, because, you know, that would not have been a good thing for him. So he hid it away in a chimney in a box and left it there till he was on his deathbed. And then it kind of took off. You know, once his daughter had the head, she sold it to a museum owner who had it on display for a number of years, and then went on to another family through a few generations, and then one of the, you know, last generation of that family had taken it around, shown it to his friends. One of his friends stole one of the ears from the head. He was kind of a drunk, so he was, like, showing it around just, you know, all sorts of places. And eventually it was sold to a former museum owner who kept it for a while, passed it on to a few other people who then exhibited it in 1799. And then it went into another family's possession, a family called Wilkinson, for five generations until it was reburied in 1960.
I would guess...
That's the nutshell.
I would guess if they dug it up again, there'd not be much left of it, huh?
it's a good question. Probably not a whole lot. It's right now it's buried in Cambridge at Sydney Sussex College. And no one knows precisely the spot. It's in the antechamber, and there's a plaque that says, you know, in this space lies the head of Oliver Cromwell, but it's not known specifically where, because they didn't want people to come dig it back up. So
why the fascination with this head?
Over time or with me?
I guess with both.
Well, I think, you know, you have this major historical figure. I mean, Cromwell was, you know, a huge part of English history. I mean, just by ending the monarchy, you know, that was a huge moment. And you still see so many bits of that just going around London. The history is such a strong piece. Even traditions in Parliament date back to that time. So I think just having the head, I mean, you know, to see that, again, it's a huge curiosity. So you can imagine people wanting to see something like that, like, oh, Cromwell's head. People know him well from history. And now you can see that head still traveling. So I think it was, again, just one of those things of natural curiosity of a major world leader that was still being passed around. And then I think once it got to his family's hands, it just became this sort of treasured possession that they kept passing down over the generations and was sort of cherished until finally this last generation, he decided that that it should no longer be passed around. It should be returned to its grave, or not the body's grave, because the body was sort of just discarded after the hanging.
That's gone, yeah.
But felt like it should have some sort of proper burial.
Is Cromwell at peace right now?
Well, I would, according to the book, no, not at all. If you go by my
really?
Book.
Really? Is there something a little paranormal happening here?
Well, because the book is a memoir, clearly...
It's,
you know,
it's basically, in the way you've set it up, it's the head is talking, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. So it's all told from the head's perspective. So the head is going through 300 years of history, all from its perspective. So what that means is it has consciousness. And that sets up a whole premise of you know, what happens after death, that we do have some sort of consciousness after death. And Cromwell's, you know, once he's aware of all this, he talks a lot about death and what that means. And so by being reburied at the end, that's a horrible thing for him, because what he discovered was that this punishment that Charles II had put on him turned out to be a blessing, because he was able to enjoy this afterlife and have a window to the world. So his struggles, he goes through all these different struggles and transformations and his beliefs throughout the journey. But, you know, he's able to still enjoy, you know, what's going on and observe things. His major struggles, he can't share any of his thoughts or ideas, except with other dead people.
I understand the head enjoys radio.
Yeah, well, once he discovers radio,
smart
radio
head.
With a telephone, he starts to wonder, you know, if something like that can help his case, and he starts to get excited about the possibilities of communicating with other dead people and being able to hear their stories. So if some sort of, you know, transmissions were able to happen within the afterlife, he finds that to be a very exciting thing, and he starts to wonder, like, all the different people he come in contact with, which really is like the concept of heaven, right? That you would be able to reconnect with family and, you know, friends, but then also just, you know, all the great people from history. And he starts to wonder about certain things, like discovering, you know, Methuselah's secrets of longevity, and, you know, if the disciples of Christ would debate with Da Vinci over the accuracy of his Last Supper. You know, so he goes through these different historical characters. He wonders about if Thomas Aquinas would reflect on his theology, having spent more than 600 years in the box, how that might change his opinions on things. So he just kind of goes through all these different hopes of what could be if they could freely speak with each other again and souls could communicate.
Our guest is Mark Hartzman. His book, the one we're talking about, is The Embalmed Head of Oliver Cromwell, a memoir. How did you ease the Elephant Man story into the book?
So at one point, his owners, again, this was one of the generations of the Wilkinson family, I have them as spiritualists. And, you know, since it's a memoir, you know, I fill in a few of the historical gaps. It follows a true story, but there's a few historical gaps, which I have to, you know, throw some imagined anecdotes in. So in one case, I have his owners being spiritualists. And so they have a seance with Cromwell, and they start to travel and do seances for other people. So I have them passing through London, and they come across the Elephant Man on exhibition. So they go to see him, and of course, you know, people are just, you know, they're kind of horrified at the sight of the Elephant Man. And once everyone sort of clears out, this couple, Horace and Hattie, decide to talk with the Elephant Man a little bit more, and they introduce him to the Cromwell head, kind of trade exhibit for exhibit. And they take him through the Cromwell story and just sort of share his history with the Elephant Man. And they tell him that they try to, you know, they were very religious people, so they talk to the Elephant Man saying that with God there's always hope. And so they go on trying to make him feel better and just give him a little touch of humanity by being kind to him. But Cromwell is observing the Elephant Man as the Elephant Man is observing him and just describing what he looks like, just with his massive tumors and just, you know, how monstrous he looks and how sad this is. And he talks about, you know, this idea of God giving hope, but wonders, you know, if God was offer hope, why is he waiting so long with the Elephant Man? You know, he says that, you know, with every crevice outlining a tumor showed that God had suspended hope. If Christ was in Merrick's heart, he was paying no attention, for this body was Satan's foul canvas. So he's just kind of appalled that, such a creature could exist. Like, how could God do this to some man? Like, why would he do something like that? So, like I said, he kind of goes through a spiritual journey throughout the book, and certain things start to make him question his faith a bit, and the Elephant Man is one of them.
And with the way you wrote it, of course, you know, in a kind of a novelistic form, how much reality do you think is behind it? When you wrote the stories and you made the head think and communicate, I mean, outside of that, obviously, I mean...
Right. Well, there's a lot. And like you said, you know, outside of the fact that I have a head talking... Yeah. Which is clearly doesn't happen. At least, you know, but then again, maybe it does. You know, how do we know? And in fact, that notion is something that's always kind of made me wonder since I was a kid of whether or not there is some sort of consciousness after death, and if burial is the wrong thing, because if burial is the wrong thing, we're all really screwed, that we're going to be trapped in the box underground in darkness. And that's horrifying. But the head, the book really does follow the true history. And I actually have a timeline in the back of the book that takes you through what's real and what's imagined. So, you know, I kind of took you through the periods of ownership and kind of where the head went. So it follows that actual guide of the journey of the different owners that possess the head. Where I had to fill in gaps, I filled in with real historical characters. So it comes into contact with real people, although those meetings didn't actually happen, like the Elephant Man. But everyone I speak about is a real historical character. So like John Hunter, the famous surgeon, who really figured out new ways to do surgery and kind of got us out of a lot of the ancient Greek methods that doctors were using for so long, and, you know, amputating things left and right. So he comes into contact with Hunter and his massive collection of curiosities. You know, he had all sorts of creatures, you know, taxidermy creatures, live creatures, things he was experimenting on. And he was actually the inspiration for Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, because he would resurrect bodies to study them, to learn, you know, procedures, and he'd sneak them in through the back door. So Cromwell's head finds himself in that room as Hunter wants to add him to his collection. He comes into contact with Dr. Robert Knox, the anatomist in Edinburgh, who worked with Burke and Hare, the two famous murderers who murdered 16 people,
right,
so they could sell fresh corpses to him.
Right. Real story.
So he comes into contact with a lot of different real characters. So there's a lot of real stories just kind of woven together through this narrative of the head's journey.
And in terms of Cromwell, how did he pull off the execution of Charles I, the king?
Well, that was just, you know, it was the English Civil War. So it was the Royalists versus the Parliamentarians. And Cromwell was leading the Parliamentarians, and they were able to put Charles I on trial, and, you know...
What, was he a lousy king?
He was a lousy king. He was, you know, he was taxing people for all the wrong reasons just to get more money, you know, taxing people that had no business being taxed for certain things.
Gosh, where have we seen that, Mark?
Right. So there was a lot of that going on, just a lot of very selfish acts that the king was doing, just because he had this divine right of kings, which was a very, you know, that was a sort of an accepted thing, that God, you know, made these people kings, and that was the way it was to be, and he just really abused it. And Cromwell was a Puritan, and he did not believe in that. He believed that God would punish people who should be punished during their time on earth, not an afterlife thing.
Right.
So for him, it was, you know, he believed he was on a mission to end the Charles I's reign. So the judge convicted Charles I, they executed him.
Well, he obviously convinced a lot of people that this king had to go. It was risky, though. It could have backfired on him.
Yeah, well, you know, it
eventually did.
Well, right, I guess so, yeah. But yeah, he had, you know, he had a lot of people on his side. Obviously, you know, there was a whole war going on for years against the Royalists. So he was leading the charge, but he had a lot of support.
So this head that literally went on tour from place to place, And now where is it? You said it's buried, but where is it?
It's at Sidney Sussex College in Cambridge.
Well, it's in a college.
Yeah, he attended Sidney Sussex for 1 year.
Okay.
And he had to return home because his father died. So he had to return home to take care of his family. He had a lot of sisters. And with his father gone, he sort of had to take over and kind of lead his family and support them. So this last generation of the Wilkinson family, when he decided he wanted to have it reburied, he chose to have it reburied at that college.
Why didn't they reunite the head with the body?
The body, no one knows exactly where the body is because after it was
Aha.
hung and beheaded, it was discarded. So some people believe it was buried near the spot where it was hung, which was at Tyburn, where they hung a lot of different people. And that's actually where Hyde Speaker's Corner and Hyde Park is. So it could be somewhere around there, but no one is certain.
Any supernatural stories that surrounded the head?
Well, in the
Anything
book,
happen to
yes.
people or anything?
What's that?
Anything happen to people or anything like that?
No, there's no stories like that, not in history. But I do have the head go through a séance, which was kind of fun. I have the people gathered around trying to contact the spirit of Cromwell with the head there on the
Huh.
table,
Now,
and
did
they're
that
going
really
through.
happen, or is that something you created for the book?
No, that was something I created for the book, and that, again, that happens in the late, sort of the later part of the 1800s when spiritualism became a real thing, and
Yeah, it was
people
huge
really
then.
believed. They thought this was like they could finally communicate with the dead, and of course that notion gives Cromwell some excitement. He's like, oh, is this like, do they finally figure something out here? So he's excited about this notion that maybe finally they could communicate with him. He's a little bit doubtful, but he's hopeful. And so I have a scene where there's a séance, and again it kind of uses the different sorts of techniques and gets into what people were actually doing at that time. And of course the head is hearing all these questions and he's trying to answer, and they're just sort of, the medium is just giving these answers that sometimes sound kind of right, but for the most part are just sort of missing it. And Cromwell realizes the whole thing is just a sham.
One bizarre story, Mark, isn't it?
It is. It's incredibly bizarre. Like I said, when I read about it, I decided I had to do something. So people can see more about this at CuriousPublications.com. It's such an incredible story. And it's funny because it came off of a story. I was kind of inspired by a story about Joseph Haydn's head, which traveled for 145 years. I thought, wow, that's incredible.
What is it
So
with
what?
these heads? Mark, we're going to come back. We're going to take some questions for you and stories. If you want to share one of your bizarre stories with us, I'll take that when we come back.